Good afternoon. It's Wednesday, the 25th of March, 2020, just after 1 o'clock. Welcome to UK Column News. Your host today, Mike Robinson, myself, Brian Gerrish. Well, blue sky and sunshine out there, Mike. Really, the only thing spoiling the world in UK is the government of occupation.
Absolutely. So let's just have a look at the latest statistics. Number of cases, 436, 1,024 of COVID-19. Deaths so far, 19,630. Recoveries, 111,878. That leaves 340,516 active cases, of which 291,275 are considered mild, and 13,241 are considered serious or critical. So now, look, what we want to do is to just run through the current state of things. And we're going to start with this because, well, the status of COVID-19 in the UK has been the subject of probably the largest flurry of emails from everybody, Brian, that I've seen in quite a long time, because this is the latest status of COVID-19 from Public Health England. And they're saying that as of the 19th of March 2020, COVID-19 is no longer considered to be a high consequence infectious disease in the UK. The Four Nations Public Health HCID group made an interim recommendation in January 2020 to classify COVID-19 as an HCID. This was based on consideration of the UK HCID criteria about the virus and the disease with information available during the early stages of the outbreak. Now that more is known about COVID-19, the public health bodies in the UK have reviewed the most up-to-date information about COVID-19 against the UK HCID criteria. They goes on to say they have determined that several features have now changed. In particular, more information is available about mortality rates, brackets low overall, and there's now greater clinical awareness and a specific and sensitive laboratory test, the availability of which continues to increase. The Advisory Committee on Dangerous Pathogens is also of the opinion that COVID-19 should no longer be classified as an HCID. So many, many people pointing this out to us, Brian, but I haven't seen any comment on this from mainstream media.
It's quite remarkable, Mike, and yes, I have to agree. I've had a lot of emails and texts where people are saying, well, what is going on here? Because this is a major declassification of COVID-19. I decided to challenge the BBC, and so we sent them an email this morning. Now, I've got to say, I phoned up the BBC press office, spoke to a very nice lady, who was helpful, but she needed information by email, which is usually how the BBC works. So what we've said is, further to my phone call on the 19th of March 2020, COVID-19 was downgraded and is no longer considered to be a high consequence infectious disease. The link is here, and I gave the BBC the link to the government's own posting, which Mike has just shown you on the screen. I said, I'm unable to find any BBC references to this important change. Can you please point me to any BBC news announcements or reports that the BBC has made on the downgrading of COVID-19? If there are none, please can you explain why the BBC has not reported this very significant change? Now, it is quite possible that we've missed this, so that if people are watching today or listening, and you know that the BBC has reported on this, then please email us and point us at where those reports are. We will be very interested to see what the BBC has said. And of course, we'll also correct effectively what we've said here. Well, we haven't seen anything to date. But let's have a look at how else and how other people are reacting to this downgrading. Now, Johnny Mercer, who we like to call Here Comes Johnny, sends out a regular a package of information, not only to his constituents, but also to other people in Plymouth. He'd sent this one out. If we do what's asked of us, we can beat this. The direction given from government is not as hard to understand as people make out. It can be summarized as follows: stay away from other people where you can, think of everyone else, particularly the vulnerable, before yourself. So that was the advice, but this is really what we were interested in, that basically his office had been emailed about the downgrading of COVID-19, and they responded by saying, yes, the government advice on that website is correct. So Johnny Mercer, as an MP, knows that COVID-19 has been downgraded. He knows where that information was posted. But his reaction is basically to carry on as if there was no change in the nature of the disease. And this is, of course, what other MPs are doing. And if the BBC, is not reporting this important change, we've got a massive deception going on here by design or ignorance. We can't be too sure.
Yeah. OK, so so let's look at what else is going on around and about. This is a new study, a new French study in the Journal for Antimicrobial Agents titled SARS-CoV-2, Fear versus Data. And they conclude that the problem of SARS-CoV-2 is probably overestimated. And that's because the normal mortality rate for SARS-CoV-2 is not significantly different from that of common coronaviruses identified at the study hospital in France. What else have we got here? This is an Italian study from August 2019, which found that flu deaths in Italy were between 7,000 and 25,000 in recent years, and that this value is higher than most other European countries due to the large elderly population in Italy, and certainly much higher than anything attributed to COVID-19 so far. But perhaps we might need to be looking at some underlying reasons why Italy is suffering so badly at the moment. And then we've got a new fact sheet, which is from the World Health Organization. Well, let's see what they have to say. The speed of transmission, this is of COVID-19, is an important point of difference between COVID-19 and influenza. Influenza has a shorter median incubation period and a shorter serial interval. The serial interval for COVID-19 virus is estimated to be 5 to 6 days, while for influenza virus, the serial interval is 3 days. This means that influenza can spread faster than COVID-19. But one of the reasons for the lockdown and the response, the government response, is that COVID-19 is much more infectious than, for example, influenza. So you might want to ask some questions about that.
And there have clearly been reports, Mike, saying that COVID-19 spreads faster than
flu. Absolutely. Yeah. So that's from the World Health Organization. What's next? Coronavirus, strange pneumonia seen in Lombardy in November, leading Italian doctor says. This is from the South China Morning Post. This is a leading Italian doctor reporting strange cases of pneumonia seen in Lombardy region as early as November 2019, raising the question if this was caused by the new virus, which officially only appeared in Italy in February 2020, or by other factors such as dangerously high smog level. That's what we've mentioned already. This is from the local.it, smog levels way above safe limits in northern Italy. So again, there may be underlying reasons why Italy is suffering so badly at the moment. Professor Peter Gotcha. Now, I do apologize for the pronunciation. That is probably wrong. Now, he's the founder of the Cochrane Medical Collaboration. And in this article, Corona, an Epidemic of Mass Panic, he's pointing out that logic is one of the first victims of this whole situation. Then here is another article here, this time from former Israeli health minister, Professor Yoram Las, who's saying that the new coronavirus is less dangerous than the flu. Lockdown measures will kill more people than the virus. And he's saying that the numbers do not match the panic. Psychology is prevailing over science. And he's also saying that Italy is known for its enormous morbidity in respiratory problems, more than three times any other European country. So the headline for that is lockdown lunacy. And then we have this one. Well, the last few here are in foreign languages, but this is Pietro Vernata, a Swiss infectious disease specialist, who's arguing that many of the measures are not based on science and should be reversed. He's saying that mass testing makes no sense because 90% of the population will see no symptoms, and lockdowns and closing schools are even counterproductive. And he's recommending only risk groups are protected while keeping the economy and society as a whole largely undisturbed. And then we have the president of the World Doctors Federation, Frank Ulrich Montgomery, who's saying that lockdown measures, as in Italy, are unreasonable, counterproductive, should be reversed. And in Switzerland, then, we have comments on the mortality, really highlighting the fact that this is that the victims in Switzerland are people that have already been on palliative care or with pre-existing conditions. And then the Italian statistics have now been published in English, so those are available. And there's some of the stats that they have. The absolute number of deaths in Italy by age group, showing that it's mainly people over 60 at least, but certainly the main areas in the 70 to 79 and 80 to 89 age groups. And then they also have a table showing the number of other problems that people have. So they had six cases with no other underlying health problems, and 113 cases at the point that these stats were listed with one underlying health condition, 128 with two underlying health conditions, 234 with three underlying health conditions and more. And then finally, they say this, for people that have died in Italy under the ages of 50, to date, 36 of the 3,200 COVID-19 positive patients under the age of 50 have died. In particular, nine of these were younger than 40 years, eight men and one woman. For two patients under the age of 40 years, no clinical information is available. The remaining seven had serious pre-existing pathologies, cardiovascular, renal, psychiatric pathologies, diabetes, obesity. So, you know, they're making the point that a large proportion of the people that have unfortunately died in Italy, the vast majority of them had underlying health conditions, and that needs to be taken into account. And, you know, the question is then, are these people dying of coronavirus or are these people dying with coronavirus? And the point that we would make is that it's with is the more appropriate word. And Brian, I was interested just looking at the BBC coverage of this last night, that when they talk about deaths as a result of this disease, they use the word with. So they're not saying that people have died of coronavirus. No. They're merely saying that they tested positive at the point of their death.
Yeah. So this is spin, isn't it? This is media propaganda and spin, because they're not giving the true facts. They're not clearly expressing what the data shows. They're putting a spin on it.
Well, let's look at how that looks, because this is going to be difficult probably for people to see on screen, but hopefully you've got a high definition feed and you can see this. This is weekly Z score, age group, total by country, and this is statistics showing excess mortality effectively. Now, Z score, for anybody that doesn't know, is a numerical measurement used in statistics, and it shows the deviation from a mean value. So the red horizontal line on each of these graphs is the zero point, and that is really the mean value, the average number of deaths at any point, any week during the year. And so then as the line moves above that red horizontal line, then that's deaths that are in excess of the average. Obviously, if it's below, then they're less than the average. Now, this runs up until week 11 of 2020, so which is the end of the 15th of March. So, you know, for example, if as we ring this particular week, this number of weeks from a couple of years ago, for these countries, we can see that there are an excess of deaths at that time. So there was some kind of pandemic or some kind of event, whether it be influenza or whatever it happens to be, which caused those additional deaths up over and above what you would normally expect to see.
We just say we can see a peak on the graph for people listening.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. But if we head over to March of this year, in fact, from the start of this year, because that last section on the graphs there is really what's happened since Christmas. We can see that up during March, in fact, most of these lines are heading downwards below the average. So that is a number of countries there, from Austria down to Greece. Let's head on down. And if we look specifically at Italy, what we find there is that, well, in general, at this point in March, that graph is showing nothing special happening in Italy with respect to excess mortality. And in fact, what we can see there is that there was more higher levels of death, a higher death rate in Italy in December and in January before this virus is supposed to have really kicked off. Now, remember, this is only running up to the 15th of March, so you've got to keep that in mind. But what that suggests, perhaps, is that the Italian Health Service was already under a bit of pressure at the beginning of the year. Maybe it's, so it was already perhaps creaking a little bit. If we look at Spain, the same story. They had a problem earlier in the year, January, February time, but certainly not in March, according to these statistics. Let's have a look at the UK. And the UK split into four separate countries here: England, Northern Ireland, Scotland and Wales. And again, we find that the level of death is well below the average in February and March, with the caveat, once again, that this is only up to the 15th of March at this point. So where have these statistics come from? Well, it's this site, Euromomo. And if you want to find that, you can. Now, this is was originally funded by the European Commission's Health and Consumer Protection Directorate. It's partnered with various institutions, universities, the Institut de Ville Sanitaire in France, and so on. France, Greece, Iceland, Ireland, Italy, Norway, Portugal, Slovenia, Spain. So this is a significant organization, including the United Kingdom's Health Protection Agency. Now, as you can see there, they do have a caveat there. Note concerning COVID-19 related mortality as part of it, because they've been approached to ask about their graphs and the fact that the graph doesn't seem to be showing any excess mortality since the COVID-19 infection. And they're making the point that their statistics are only up until the 15th of March. You know, they're always running a couple of weeks behind. So we've got to take that into account. If you want to go and look at this website for yourself, you'll find it at euromomo.eu. But what I will say is that their statistics match the statistics of the Office of National Statistics. And what we have here is the orange line showing the average mortality for each week since the beginning of the year up until week 11. The orange line is the average of the past 5 years, and the red line is this year's results. And as you can see, right along from the 1st of January right up until the 15th of March, we've been sitting below that average line. So again, the question has to be asked, why have we reacted in the way that we have? I don't know the answer to that.
Well, I think we're getting glimpses now, and we're going to cover a bit more of it in a minute, Mike. But what a situation where we're just talking UK at the moment. We've got a whole nation put into lockdown based on statistics which we can say appear to be inaccurate, erroneous, disagreeing with each other. We don't need to go much stronger than that. We just say that all of the actions that have been taken about what's happened in the country, people can't travel, people got to stay at home, people who are sole traders are going to be hit extremely hard. But the statistics is sand.
Well,
I'm
going to say that the statistics are absolutely accurate. It's the way that the statistics are being presented
yeah.
which
okay,
is not
fair
accurate.
Comment. Yeah. Yeah. Well, let's have a look at the question that nobody wants to answer. And it's this one. If NHS staff are critical in dealing with COVID-19, why can't UK authorities answer this simple question? And the question is this: how many NHS staff have or have had COVID-19? Now, we thought this was a very easy and straightforward question a week ago when we started to see if we could find out what the answer was. But what's rapidly become apparent is that, we don't know. Mm-hmm. Public Health England slope-shouldered and told us to go to NHS England NHS England told us to go to the Department of Health. And we can add today that we've also spoken to the Royal College of Nursing. And it was obvious from a very helpful individual that they have no details on the number of NHS staff that have been infected. However, the NHS staff, of course, have been in the front line. They've been exposed, apparently, to people who've already contracted COVID-19. So we would expect to see some significant statistics. But apparently, the prepared British government doesn't have any statistics to do with the NHS. And this is surprising, excuse me, because the government documentation itself, which talks about guidance for infection prevention and control in healthcare settings, tells us some very interesting things. This is the document. Now, several people have said that they really like the statistics that UK Column's been putting up over the last week, but said people have said to us, please, where you can, give the sources of this information. So this is from the www.gov.uk documents website. And the first one is the guidance there, COVID-19. Why are we interested in this document? Well, in section 7, it gets on to occupational health and staff deployment. And if we have a look at that in more detail, what does it say? It says that the prompt recognition of cases of COVID-19 amongst healthcare staff is essential to limit the spread. And we ask ourselves, how does that work when at the moment the government departments that are tasked with looking after the wider health in UK have no statistics, particularly on NHS staff? Is this incompetence, Mike, or is this part of a deception over what's actually taking place on the ground? Well, it's difficult to tell.
It's very hard to tell. I mean, for example, perhaps the figures don't fit the narrative, and that's why they won't be released.
Yeah.
That's a good question.
Well, I'll just add that in making all the phone calls that we did to try and track down these statistics, one of the things that came up very strongly was NHS people saying, well, never mind who's got COVID-19. What you really need to know is that we still haven't got our personal protection equipment. So the masks and the gowns, gloves are available, but in some cases, the hand gels and hand washes aren't. So the NHS staff in the front line saying that the system has broken down with respect to supplies of these personal protective equipment. Mm. Meanwhile, we're told by equally reliable sources that HMS Prince of Wales, that's the second of Britain's enormous aircraft carriers, with no aircraft at the moment, of course, but that aircraft carrier is patrolling off the south coast, was sighted in the Sidmouth area, may well be closer to Plymouth. But we understand that they've got troops on board. So very, very interesting. What are these troops for, Mike? Mm. Where might they be deployed? Well, we don't know, but that's the information. We've also had it on extremely good authority that the Metropolitan Police have been sending men and women home for the slightest sniffle. And at the moment, policing levels in London are at very depleted levels. People with genuine sickness have been sent home, but we understand that other people are making use of the fact that they only have to sniff and they're sent home. And the comment from a very experienced Metropolitan Police officer was that London is being put into a very dangerous situation because there was no policing on the streets. And I'll just end by saying that locally, fascinating to watch a queue of people for a local GP surgery extending out the door and up the street in a very, very cold wind, with individuals stood 6 feet apart in silence. It was utterly bizarre. As somebody commented to me, surreal what is happening in this country.
Okay, if you like what the UK Column's doing and you would like to support us, then please head over to ukcolumn.org/community. Your help very much needed and very much appreciated. So you can do that there. Now, we've been mentioning this week the coronavirus bill. This is this emergency legislation which has been going through Parliament. It was introduced into Parliament on Monday. It went through the House of Lords yesterday. It's going to be passed today and be given royal assent pretty much immediately. Of course, the most dystopian language in this is the idea of supporting and protecting the public to do the right thing and follow public health advice. Now, we were making the point, of course, that the expiry of the bill was, as it was originally written, was 2 years, except for a whole host of different sections of the bill. That there had been an amendment, in fact, several amendments, all basically doing the same thing, to try to make sure that the bill expires at a much earlier period, a period of 6 months, beginning of the date which is passed, and that then it would have to be approved by Parliament to be extended. Well, in fact, in order to head this whole thing off at the pass, the government did put in its own amendment to this, which gives the Commons an opportunity to express a view on the continued operation of the temporary provisions every 6 months. So apparently a minister must, as far as practicable, make arrangements for MPs to vote on this every 6 months. And if they're able to vote, then the bill will stay in force if they approve it. And if they don't, obviously it won't. But there's a nice little caveat in this, because MPs will only be able to vote on the continuation of the bill if they're actually sitting. And unfortunately, Parliament is expected to close tonight. So will it be sitting in 6 months' time whenever this bill comes up for renewal? Because if they don't vote on it, the powers will remain in force by default. So we are in the situation where democracy effectively being suspended in this country tonight in the event that Parliament is shut down. And this bill, which is an enabling bill, it will become an enabling act, effectively will run for 2 years without any parliamentary scrutiny if Parliament does not sit again in the next 6 months.
Mike, this has got to be one of the most dangerous positions this country's ever been in. We ask a question, who is the government at the moment? We've had glimpses of names such as Dominic Cummings, but of course we know that in the background there's a cabal of people that simply are telling the backbench MPs what they should be doing. So if you're an MP, we understand that that doesn't mean to say that you've got any part in the democratic running of UK. We've got a cabal described by David Scott, I think very accurately, as a government of occupation. And now they are simply suspending the constitution, all on statistics, which you've described quite rightly, Mike, as saying these are manipulated statistics.
It seems that way. So here's George Freeman, because it doesn't end there. He's now calling for a government of national unity. We had this under Brexit that didn't really fly. Is it going to fly this time? So he tweeted out yesterday, the scale of this national emergency, the suspension of usual freedoms and democracy, the economic consequences and the likely loss of tens of thousands of lives demands a suspension of party politics as usual. We're going to need a COVID coalition.
Well, I just have to comment on this one. It's the terminology there, the likely loss of tens of thousands,
yes,
of lives. So we have Public Health England, can't remember the gentleman's name, but saying 600,000 people were going to die in UK. And now we've got people saying, well, we might have the likely loss of 10,000 lives. So
well, anyway, he did that. And then he was, of course, promoting an article in The Guardian, which he gave an interview for. And this says that George Freeman, a former minister in Johnson's government, was the first to break cover and say a COVID coalition government may be unavoidable. Some other Tory MPs privately believe the Prime Minister will need cross-party governing consensus if emergency measures are to continue for months. Freeman told The Guardian, the scale of this national emergency demands a suspension of politics as usual. When Labour have a sensible new leader, Keir Starmer, if elected, should be invited to COVID cabinet, COBRA and joint number 10 briefings. The Guardian saying one argument circulating among some Tories is that Johnson may need to share responsibility for decision making with Labour and other opposition parties in order to survive the crisis. Well, I think opposition parties might want to think twice about that, because we know what happened to the Liberal Democrats when they were sharing power with the Tories in 2010 to 2015. They effectively ended up not being a functioning party anymore, because the problems that arose out of that government basically stuck to them somehow.
Yeah.
Now, what's next? Right. Coronavirus, the new jobless struggle to claim benefits, says the BBC. And really, this is one of the key problems that we have. And let's have a look at this. One user posted a screenshot on Twitter of their application. This is an application for benefits, which said that due to the incredible volume of new users, there would be 105,563 people ahead of them in an online queue to verify their identity, a basic requirement for applying for any benefit. So you put this along, you know, in the same lines as perhaps what was going on with the big pub chain, whose name escapes me at the moment,
Wetherspoons,
who's laid off effectively, they haven't laid them off, 40,000 staff, but they're not paying anything to them until the government money comes in, possibly at the end of April. And so a video from the chief executive suggesting that perhaps they might want to find jobs elsewhere in the meantime. So a lot of people are going to suffer pretty harshly over the next number of weeks, because there's going to be a pretty significant delay between applications being made and money coming through. And even when the money comes through, is it really sufficient? I don't think so.
Yeah. And I'll just add that we're told, it's an anecdotal story, but I'm sure it's true, that one of the Plymouth taxi drivers said how vulnerable he and other taxi drivers felt, because he said most of us have only got a month's money to live on, and he'd been told to go home by the police the other night. So this is pretty draconian stuff, and we don't know who's really running the country. Mm. Now, we just mentioned this little funny story, really, but somebody picked up that just as coronavirus hits the streets, an interesting charity emerges from the shadows, the National Emergencies Trust. And if you go to their website, they've got a big coronavirus appeal there. On the right is a little bit of documentation from the Charities Commission, where you can see more detail. Their charitable objects are to relieve and to enable the relief of sickness or disability, physical or mental, the victims of emergency incidents. On and on and on it goes. They were registered on the 4th of April 2019. I thought that's rather convenient for a National Emergencies Trust. If you read their own documentation, they say, well, it was Grenfell Tower that prompted us to set ourselves up. But what do they want to do? Well, they want to act as a central coordinating point for donations whenever there's a national emergency. And then we don't have to worry, because they'll follow those charitable objects there, and they will sort the problem out. Now, we always have a little look at people, and just fascinating. They've got Danit there, former chief of the head of the army. He's there now. Obviously, that gives the solid ground of somebody who's capable of dealing and handling with an emergency. Number two on his right was Gerald Oppenheim, a very interesting gentleman, because he's chief executive of the fundraising regulator. Now, they're all independent, which is very good. But of course, they've now got an organisation which says, well, when a national emergency happens, you don't really need to set up local charities. You can get involved with us. And I rather feel that what they have set up is what's in their logo, which is a net, which is drawing in people so that you don't even have to think or work in your communities. So we'll keep an eye on that and see where it leads.
Right. Now, Ryan, as we were preparing the news this morning, the organisation Full Fact came up again in conversation, because we noticed that Full Fact have been checking many of the statistics that the Office for National Statistics are pushing out, and Government Statistics Service. But we came across this, which we thought was a little bit interesting, because this is secondment to Full Fact, and the Government Statistics Service has secured an opportunity for staff to gain experience communicating statistics to a varied audience of policymakers, journalists and the general public through short-term secondments to Full Fact. Now, of course, Full Fact is the fact-checking organisation which Facebook is using for fact-checking on that platform. This is going back. I think this was a civil service advertisement. I think this was 2018, so it's a couple of years ago. But nonetheless, this seems to be a bit of a revolving door. Brian, if an organisation which is there apparently to provide fact-checking for the media, of the media and of government, is then accepting government staff in as on secondment to present the statistics better, that's a bit...
It's a bit iffy, isn't it? And, of course, Full Fact was born out of Leveson, if I remember correctly, that investigation and criticism of the press and media was going on, it ultimately led through to Full Fact.
Yes.
So, yeah.
Yeah. And we'll just end with this one, which I thought was quite interesting. The Government Chemist Conference, 2020. It was due to take place 24th to 25th of June 2020. It's been put off, apparently, for some time because of COVID-19. I was just fascinated at the topics for discussion at this event. Genetically modified organisms, desirability and plausibility of meat alternatives, food authenticity. So when you're making food in a factory, you want to make it as authentic as possible.
As possible, yeah.
Brian, this is Safe Food for Tomorrow's World was the title of the conference. This is all about the type of food that we're going to have in the future. And what fascinated me most about it, Brian, there is no discussion of farming in this conference at all. This is just about this is the Government Chemist Conference.
Yeah.
This is just about artificial manufacturing of food-like materials, which should give some sustenance. It's interesting that we find the same types of policies coming through multiple different organisations. We'll keep an eye on that for the future.
Yeah. Well, we know there's a very big attack on farming coming up, so hopefully we can do some more on that. Perhaps we just end. Somebody said in the chat box a few minutes ago, coronavirus is all very Novichok.
Yes.
Which I thought was quite appropriate. Well, we'll leave it there. Very dangerous times for UK. Do we have a government? If it's not visible, who's running it? A lot of questions to be asked. And to say to people who are contacting us, saying how concerned you are and what can you do, one of the key things you can do is take the data and statistics that we are showing you and use that in letters to challenge not only your own MP, but people in the so-called positions of authority, to ask them what they're doing, challenge the media, challenge the BBC. It's very, very powerful, if you put in very measured letters or emails, but is accompanied by documents, particularly if the data has come from government or government approved sources itself. So don't sit there worrying, take some action, because the action conquers fear. Thanks for joining us. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.